morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The site is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, we are moving to 101.1 FM. That is our new location on the FM frequency, so we're simulcasting with 90.7 for a while, but retune your dials to 101.1. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Krishnan Venkatesh. He is the director of the Graduate Institute of Liberal Education at St. John's College. Right now, I'd like to welcome Tracy Crum. She is a professor of art and design at North Carolina State University at Raleigh, and she's here in Santa Fe doing a public art project at the Museum of International Folk Art. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's nice to have you here, and it's a very interesting project you're doing. It's a large-scale textile project that's being created not only by you, but by visitors to the museum, members of the general public.
That's correct. The project was conceived in order to incorporate as many people as possible, and we really wanted to be able to incorporate every single visitor that came to the museum, if that was the case. So what I did was I planned two very simple textile construction techniques that people could learn very, very quickly. And so they can come. We're set up in the outdoor classroom outside the museum. And people can come and I can teach them very quickly how to make these textiles. And there are a variety of materials that we're working with. And they're helping me construct components that are going to be incorporated into two or three larger structures in the Milner Plaza.
And so people show up, and you're sitting there on the plaza, Milner Plaza, in front of the Museum of International Folk Art, the other museums right nearby, and you are doing some a technique which is called what? Finger crocheting?
We're doing finger knitting or finger weaving, as it's known, and then we're also doing, I'm calling it hand crochet, and basically the idea behind the project, it's in response to the Needles and Pins exhibition. Which is about an exhibition about textiles and tools and how tools have been used to construct fabrics throughout history. And the idea behind the public art project is to not use tools. And so we're using our fingers and our hands and, you know, various body parts to construct the textile structure.
So toes? Elbows?
I guess it could get to that extent. I mean, I'm actually hoping that we'll have a couple of large groups of, school-age kids come, and they can actually function as knitting needles, for example. So they could all stand in a row, and they would be the knitting needles, and then a couple other students would weave the fibers in and around the knitting needles, and they could create a really, really huge textile. So we're hoping to actually get the project to that scale, but right now we're primarily just working with individuals that come and want to learn how to do the finger knitting or want to learn how to crochet by hand. And it makes a much larger scale fabric than a normal textile tool would make. So people,
because the materials are big and your fingers are big, and so
and your hand is big. And so instead of constructing a fabric that's really like the fabrics we know, we're constructing more like these sort of net-like structures. And we're using a stretchy rubber material, and we're using PVC flagging tape. And the choices behind the materials came about because we needed to use something that was going to be a larger scale than what would typically be known as a textile fiber. And we also needed to have something that would be able to exist outside, hopefully for the duration of the Needle and Pins exhibit, which goes through next April. So we had to think about products that would actually withstand lots of rain and ultraviolet light and that sort of thing. So
so they go from being PVC rubber tape to being giant textiles. Your people are making parts of them. You are participating in making parts of these things. And then you sew them together?
We're actually trying to construct them in as few pieces as possible. So what we're doing is we could sew them together, but for example, the finger knit pieces are actually going to be stretched under tension from one structure in the Milner Plaza to another. So the finger knit elements will actually retain their integrity as singular elements, but they'll be used together. So that, and we won't be attaching the parts. The hand crocheted pieces are actually going to be stretched like a very, very large piece of fabric between a couple of other structures in the plaza. And those pieces we're either trying to stick with the crochet technique and actually crochet them together, or if it comes down to it, we'll use just a basic sort of stitching technique. But everything by hand. I mean, no needles. As long as you can get your little hands in there and attach materials together, then it fits with the project.
What has been the participation of the visitors to the museum? Do they see what you're doing and come over and help?
Yeah, a lot of interest so far. Today will be the fifth day of the project, and we're going to be going for about another 2.5 weeks, I think through August 12th. And I think we've been getting probably 20 to 40 participants a day, which has been really great. And a lot of people will come in and they'll sit down and they'll simply just learn the technique, do it for maybe 5 minutes, contribute a couple inches to one of the parts or the pieces, and that's it. But we've also had other people that have come and sat and spent an hour or two with me. And also a lot of people that want to just come and talk about, you know, their experiences with textiles or something that their grandmother did or something that somebody learned in school or whatever. And, you know, and there's just a lot of sort of general conversations about art, about public art, and about the art scene in Santa Fe and all that. I mean, it's been really, really pretty diverse and dynamic. All ages. We've had, you know, everything from little tiny kids to, you know, just pretty much everybody that has come through the museum. So
it does bring up a question that's sort of interesting, which is, to what extent are people learning to do handcrafts, textiles, sewing, embroidery, knitting, crocheting in their regular lives?
Well, you know, I definitely think there's been a resurgence in all this kind of stuff, and I think it's because it seems to have sort of skipped the younger generation right now, and I think that they're sort of coming back to some of these, you know, historic, I would say almost craft techniques, because it's something that, you know, something that maybe they knew somebody in another generation of their family knew how to do, and they just, there's an interest in it. And I also find that doing this kind of work takes a lot of focus. So it's something that, you know, people realize they can sit down and they can actually calm down, they can actually think while they're doing it, they can actually have a conversation while they're doing it. I was actually really surprised. I thought that more of the younger kids would know both of these techniques, because I remember, you know, growing up in the early 70s, and everybody did finger knitting, and everybody knew what lanyard lacing was, and we all did braiding and knotting
and macrame
totally.
And needlepoint.
Macrame, and you know, the kids now, both, especially, you know, boys and the girls, had most of them that I've dealt with in the last few days have had no experience doing this, and it's very new to them, and they don't think about it as like, oh, is it a craft, is it an art? They just, it's just something that can make a really interesting material. And I think the fact that we've chosen a stretchy rubber material makes it really interesting to them, because all of a sudden it's not a fabric. They're not thinking about textile. They're
right.
Not thinking about anything that might have some sort of, you know, gender orientation to it in terms of making art. They're just like working with this really cool rubber stuff.
Yeah, the gender orientation thing is really kind of a double-edged sword, because I was in the 70s in a public school in rural upstate New York, and I was, I think, probably in the very last gender-separated home ec class, and in that home ec class I learned to sew, mend, cut out patterns, you know, use tracing wheels, all this really technical tailoring stuff that probably kids even 5 years younger than me never learned.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, gender segregation is a problem in a lot of ways, but in some ways it has that silver lining, which is you actually learn stuff.
Mm-hmm. And useful stuff. I mean, I can't tell you how many you know, kids just as part of this are getting an idea about, like, what sewing is, you know,
right.
And they have no idea what sewing is. And in my mind, it's like, well, of course you learn how to sew, because how are you going to fix your clothes, you know? And it's just, you know, kind of reaches out even further into these ideas about being able to, like, maintain and take care of and repair things, you know? And I think that's one of the reasons why I learned so much about textile stuff when I was younger, was because, you know, we had to take care of everything that we had, and if we wanted something, we made our own clothes, you know. And I really got into that, because everything that I was able to do through making things on my own made what I had completely unique, and that was something that was really, really interesting to me. And just sort of makes me think of sort of a segue here into thinking about people participating in this project. You know, they're able to come in and sit down and learn something very simply, but participate in something that's much bigger. You know, it's the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and I think that's been really exciting for people to come in and just learn something that's so basic and contribute to something that's going to be seen on a much bigger public scale.
And this is the Milner Plaza right in front of the Museum of International Folk Art. We're talking to Tracy Crum. And it's interesting, too, because people can participate in, and they can be there for an hour or 2 hours, and they can make 2 or 3 feet long section of the fabric, mm-hmm. but it's not really theirs, because they don't, once it's up, they won't have ownership and say, that's my little red square.
Mm-hmm. It's been interesting, because people have been sitting down and working and then saying, well, do we get to take this home, or do we get to, and I'm like, and then I get back into an explanation of, no, this is part of a large-scale public art project, and everybody that's sitting down with me is contributing to this, potentially 20 by 40 foot, piece of constructed fabric. And a lot of people have, when they think about it that way, I'll suggest to them, well, maybe you want to put like a special knot, or maybe you want to make a mistake in what you're doing so that if you come back to the plaza in the next 6 months, you can look at the overall art piece and try to figure out which part you made, So a lot of people have...
So they do take their little ownership, but it's personal. Nobody else would know that it was there.
Exactly. Nobody else would know. And then it also, sometimes just imbuing something with just a little bit of your, a little bit of uniqueness of yourself makes it easier for these people to just give up what they're doing on a, for the greater good. So that's it's been interesting working with the public just because you have to sort of bend yourself around all these sort of different kinds of personalities and, different learning styles. And, that's part of the project that really is exciting to me is being able to just interact with so many different kinds of people and introduce them to something that they don't have any idea that they were coming to the museum to participate in this. And
I have been to, and there must be many examples of this. A family will come to Santa Fe, and three of them or two of them want to go into the museum, and one of them really doesn't. So they sit outside on the plaza, and they either go buy food and beverages, or they work on their suntan or skin cancer, whatever. But now they've got something to do. When are you there?
I am there every day except Mondays and Tuesdays from noon until 5. And if it's pouring rain,
So Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 5.
Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 5 until the 12th of August. And I believe the 12th is on a Monday, but that'll be like the final installation day, so that we'll be wrapping everything up and actually getting the structures, firmly in place so that they can stay up for the next 6 months. If I'm not outside because it's raining, I have a cart that I'm pushing all my materials on, and I park it in front of the Needles and Pins exhibition and set up a table with chairs in there. So we have plenty of room for, groups of, I think we had a group of 10 women came in the other day from the Crochet Guild of Albuquerque and made places for all of them.
The Crochet Guild of Albuquerque.
It was completely unexpected. They came to see the Needles and Pins exhibition, and this was just sort of a bonus. So this has been sort of a surprise for a lot of people because we put the project together in the last month and a half or so, so there hasn't been a tremendous amount of PR, and we're really, at this point just inviting everybody that's possibly interested to come and participate. We need as much help as possible. The more people we get, the bigger the structures are going to be and the more visible, and the community effort certainly is a really big part of the project.
And they'll be up for the whole rest of the year and in through April of next year.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Crum is a professor of art and design at North Carolina State University at Raleigh and is here at the Milner Plaza at the Museum of International Folk Art Wednesdays through Sundays, at least for the next, would you say, the week or two?
It's about 2.5 weeks I think we have left. So good amount of time for everybody to come on out. And
bring your kids.
That's right.
Good. Well, we'll see you there, Tracy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to hear a commentary now from Ron Bloomberg and from some of our beloved underwriting folks, and then we will be back talking about St. John's College. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. Here are some bits and pieces. Sicko is one of the most important documentaries ever made. It's powerful, advocates free health care for everyone in our country. But will it ever happen? With insurance companies, HMOs, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare lobbyists fighting it, I'd say take 2 aspirins and stay out of drafts. So there's a move on in the Senate to censure President Bush. How about going for the word with peach in it? The St. John's concerts on the Hill were better than advertised. Good setting, great music, and free popcorn. And I never knew I was held in such high regard by so many people. I mean, every day without fail, I receive in the mail the most flattering letters. I just hope I don't get a big head. Let me read you one of the many thousands that have come in. Dear Ron Blumberg, we only send this to exceptionally responsible people like you. Get this. Not everyone deserves the power and prestige of the Platinum MasterCard, but you do. Me, go figure. You have been pre-qualified for our 0% intro APR on purchases through 2008. Wow, I don't know quite what to say. It's such an honor. Now there's a law that should be enacted. You miserable credit card companies, stop sending me that junk mail. Leave those trees alone. Stop wasting all that paper. And before I get too worked up, let me leave you with a tribute to this year's British Open winner, the lad from Ireland, Patrick Harrington.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger.
Congratulations, Patrick, and I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome Krishnan Venkatesh. He is director of the Graduate Institute of Liberal Education at St. John's College right here in Santa Fe and is also a faculty member there. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on the show.
I'm delighted to have you here. I am a graduate of the Graduate Institute myself, and we really haven't talked about St. John's as an institution on this show in the many years that I've been here. What is St. John's? It has a different philosophy and method of education than your average college.
Yeah, it's a very strange place, and I think most Santa Feans, most New Mexicans, don't really appreciate what a weird place they have. It's a treasure. What we do is great books, as many people know, and it's great books from across the disciplines. So it's philosophy, literature, mathematics, science, and we study the books that are foundational to the West, and in the Graduate Institute also to the East. We have two master's programs there. So what we tend to do is we try to get into the books to see what questions they're asking, what are the major challenges that each book poses to a human life, and we stretch ourselves to understand those things. We do it in a conversation class. Everyone sits around the table. The tutor is what we call a faculty member. Tutor will ask a question, and the students will start discussing from there. That's what we do.
So this is very different from the, for example, my undergraduate education at a you know, big fancy liberal arts college. I would go to the first class. There would be a lecture with, you know, 75 people there. They'd have a reading list with 15 books that all had 200 or 300 or 400 pages, and there was no way to get through the whole thing. It was impossible. At St. John's, every reading that you take, that you bring into your seminar, that you bring into your class, is digestible. They don't give you 500 pages at a time. Sometimes a reading is 25 or 30 or 50 pages.
That's right. That's right. Or 5 pages, depending on how difficult the reading is. If you see on the syllabus that your reading for Thursday is 5 pages long, you know you're going to have to read it 20 times.
What's an example of a 5-page reading that's so hard?
Hegel or Kant.
Right.
Yes.
and do you find that the students are prepared and they have read it, if not 20 times, they've read it multiple times?
Yeah, in general, the students are exceptionally well prepared. This is a place where people go who are really hungry to read and to learn and to study. And these are the people who, on their own, tend to choose tough texts to read. They like reading difficult books, books that challenge them. And most of them in their home lives are lonely. They feel very isolated, and they come to this place, and there are, you know, 500 people just like
just
them.
Just like them.
Just like them.
Weird, lonely nerds.
Yes, yes. Although getting less nerdy.
But, and less lonely, we hope.
Less lonely. Yeah, this is a place where in October, one of the sights of St. John's is 17 and 18-year-olds coming out of the bookstore really excited at buying the complete works of Aristotle and Plato. Where else in the country do you find that?
Excellent point. It seems that the St. John's method of reading great books, and by the way, there's another thing I want to talk about with that, is that you don't read secondary sources or criticism or commentaries. You read the texts themselves and really let them speak to you. Why?
I think we have faith that the human mind, any human mind, when it's switched on and confronted with a difficult question that relates to human life, that human mind, once it's thinking, will go somewhere. And I always think that the reason our program works is that if a human being just thinks about something, even if it's for just 10 minutes, what they have to say is nearly always very interesting. You know, if you talk with someone about the major crises in their life, or about their family members, or about their work, something they've actually thought about, what they have to say is always interesting, and you learn from that. Most of the time, though, about big issues like justice or politics, the trouble is that people don't think, and they usually give you the opinions that they've heard, and they haven't thought them through. So at St. John's, I think the reason our classes work is that everyone's switched on, and so when you have 12 to 18 people in the room who are switched on and actually thinking, it's amazing what happens, and you get some really original work done.
It's very interesting, the point you make about politics, that people are repeating received opinions as if they were their own. Do you see that when you're, for example, you're a tutor in a class and people come in and they might be saying a received opinion and then something changes during the course of the class when the discussion gets deeper?
Yes, all the time. For example, when you're reading the Greeks, I'd say that for most of the books that we read in our programs, whether it's Greek or Hebrew or Chinese or Indian, for example, one thing that most of the texts agree on is that democracy isn't the best form of government. And, so there's an opinion that we take for granted and that gets tested by a whole bunch of people who appear to be smarter than we are. Right,
including Plato's Republic.
Including Plato's Republic, yeah.
It was funny. I was trying to find last night in preparation for this. I remember in the 1980s, the Vice President of the United States, Danforth Quayle, claimed to be rereading the Republic every year. And there was this moment, and I couldn't find verification of it, so I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly. But there was this moment where a journalist asked him what he thought about the cave allegory, and he just said he didn't remember that part. But he. but he used it, he said he was reading it to remind him that democracy was the best form of government, and that's exactly the opposite of what it says.
Exactly the opposite, yes. Yeah, yeah.
But in any case, there's something about the St. John's teaching method that can go two ways. On the one hand, it's entirely democratic, because anybody can come in, read these books, talk about them, and get somewhere. On the other hand, there's also, in some circles, a kind of an attitude that these great texts are really only for the super elite, and they are a kind of esoteric set of texts that the hoi polloi can't understand.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we don't think they're esoteric. We think that each of these texts will teach you how to read it, if you pay attention. And that goes for the Eastern text, too.
Let's talk about the Eastern texts. When I was at St. John's, they were just beginning to institute the Eastern Classics program, and I wondered how well the Eastern texts lend themselves to a Western seminar, university-style analysis, given that many of them, at least I took a preceptorial there where they were sort of warming up for the Eastern Classics program and approaching it in a very Western style, and I brought up the fact that some of these texts were really meant to be read in the context of a monastery by monks who were practicing, and the text made sense in that context. Can you read them in seminar?
Some of these, yes, I think we can, because many of the texts that were read in monasteries were also texts that were designed for the monks to debate. For example, most people don't know this, but the Dalai Lama went to universities that were universities of dialectic, where Buddhists would debate various positions about metaphysics. So the presupposition that you often hear in Santa Fe, especially, that the West is linear and logical and the East is non-linear and intuitive.
Intuitive.
Yeah, it's just wrong.
That's a stereotype.
It's a stereotype. It's a terrible stereotype. And in a way, it's a slap in the face to the Indian, the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition, because as if, one is saying, oh, they can't think, but they know lots of other things. And, when you read the Hindus and the Buddhists, you see that there's this there's a level of argumentation there that actually makes Thomas Aquinas sometimes seem sloppy. You know?
Ladies and gentlemen, that is funny. If you haven't read Aquinas, you should go read like the first two paragraphs of any Aquinas text, and you will see how difficult it is to get through that kind of logic. Now, well, we've had Tibetan monks on this program, and a good part of their day is devoted toward arguing about the text that they've read.
Yes.
But it's still different because they're spending the rest of the time meditating, and that feeds into the, presumably, into the ability to argument and to argue, and the things that you learn when through that combination between silence and conversation.
Yes. Yeah, you will never, I mean, in your own sphere of life, you will never exactly duplicate the sphere of life of any of the books you're reading, because you're different. That's what difference means. When you read Homer, it doesn't mean you have to wrestle or throw a spear to be able to understand Homer. But that's where you take, you latch on to the openings that you can get in the text, and then you try to see how your own life is a practice for that. For example, with the Eastern texts, I think that the seminar discussion is a very difficult and very important spiritual practice, to be able to listen to somebody, right? Listening well is probably the hardest thing a human being has to do. You don't master it. And so in seminar, to practice the kind of patience and generosity and accurate listening to people who disagree with you about fundamental things, that's part of a spiritual practice. Now, certain other aspects of practice we can't do, because you can't do everything in our lives. But I think some very important parts we do.
When you are looking, when you're a tutor of Western philosophy and classic great books, that as people are at St. John's, and it's those same faculty members who are teaching the Eastern classics, what does the learning curve look like to be able to teach the Eastern stuff? I mean, I had this one experience where I took a preceptorial called Philosophies of India or something like that, and the tutor was comparing a particular Buddhist text to Aristotle and was saying that this was really nihilism because there was no God. And I thought, wow, this person is really putting a very Western overlay on something that maybe can't be understood using the same tools.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, in that case, I don't think it's particularly Western, because the Buddhists themselves knew that in their cultures, their texts could be taken as nihilistic. So, so the possibility of response is equally wide in whatever culture you go to. When you get a more intuitive person like Zhuangzi, or a more rational person like Shankara, they're also assuming that they have the same spectrum of readers and responses that someone like Aristotle or Hume would assume.
When somebody goes through the Eastern Classics program at St. John's, there's a language component to it.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Every student in the Eastern Classics program has to study either Sanskrit or Classical Chinese. And this is one thing that makes this program very unique in the world.
Now, Chinese is very, very hard. I've never had a brush with Sanskrit, but it takes people years and years to master the most basic rudiments of writing characters, and much less the tones, much less speaking any kind of intelligible Chinese. What can you really do in a four-semester program?
At St. John's in general, we don't strive for prowess. We're actually very proud of our amateur our amateur approach to things. And what this approach means is that we're really looking at the language in order to bring us closer to fundamental questions and make us more intimate with the text. So with either Sanskrit or Chinese, obviously in a year you can't get very far, but it's a beginning. And it enables you to understand what any given translator is doing. So when someone translates Tao in this or that way, why. You have a pretty good sense. And incidentally, you also get much closer to a text.
What is your background? Where are you from?
My two very different answers to those. My background is English literature, and that's where I spent most of my time, and I still love English poetry most. And where I'm from, I was born in Malaysia, and my father's Indian, my mother's Chinese, so I'm very sort of at ease with a cosmopolitan Asian background.
Did you grow up speaking Chinese or speaking any other languages besides English?
Yeah, when I was a small kid, we spoke a mixture of Hakka, Cantonese, and Malay. Hakka is one of the South Chinese languages, and it's the language of the Chinese gypsies. My mother is Hakka. These are people whose women never bound their feet. So they're very, very proud and independent and uneducated in the best way.
What was your religious tradition?
Primarily atheistic, because my father was an Indian doctor who rebelled from a highly orthodox Brahmin tradition, and he would expose none of his kids to any of that stuff. His father was extremely orthodox, and in fact, when my father married my mother, an Indian marrying a Chinese, that caused a huge hullabaloo. Marrying outside caste, marrying outside his parents' wishes. So it was really a breaking with tradition. My existence is only possible because of colonialism. And in a way that what I've been trying to do at St. John's is to understand better some of these intellectual roots that my grandfathers would have taken for granted that I've been cut away from.
For example?
For example, the Upanishads, the Rig Vedas, just the Vedic tradition. My grandfather was steeped in those.
And so what is it like for you to go back to those? I mean, does it feel like your own roots, these Brahmin roots?
In a way, yes. In a way, no. Because I spent more time with my Chinese family, so the Chinese texts feel very, very familiar to me. But the Indian texts, there's something that I've had to work through with a kind of generational conflict in my own family. My father rebelled against his father. I rebelled against my father. So having to kind of work through the layers has been important. But the Indian texts are exciting to me. Very exciting.
What is the makeup of the Graduate Institute, the Eastern and Western? Are these people, do they tend to be people who just graduated from college, or they tend to be older students, or what does it look like?
We have a very exhilarating mix of people. We tend to get three groups of people. One group of people is the people who are newly graduated, who are looking for ways to broaden before they specialize further, or who are looking to fill in the gaps in their education. Then they're really smart and up and coming and energetic. Then you have the people at the end of their lives, the retired people. They've worked hard, they had a career, they had a family, they've always wanted to reflect and read, and now finally is their time. And then you have the midlife people, the midlife professionals who come here because they're looking for some new window to life. They want some program that will help them to make a crack in their lives that they can pry open and go into something new. And when you put those three kinds of people together in a room, it's like an ideal mix, very combustible.
What are some of the kinds of combustion that you see? I mean, we're talking about conflicts here.
Yeah, conflicts. So for example, if you're studying King Lear, you have a play about an 80-year-old man who leaves his kingdom because he's getting ready to die, but he can't quite let go, right? So when you have a couple of people who are around that age or thinking about that stage in the room, then you have a few people for whom 40 seems old, and then you have a few people around 30 to 40 who can understand both the perspective of the daughters and also the perspective of the older generation, then all of a sudden you can say things, you can see things in the text that say an 18-year-old might not see.
And this is something that is harder to come by in the undergraduate program, because the people there tend to be younger, tend to be just out of high school.
Yes, yes. In the undergraduate program, what you have is this astounding originality that these 18-year-olds, they say things, you have no idea how they could know this. And probably when they at 45 reread one of their essays written at this time, they'll probably be amazed. I said that then? How did I know that? By the time you're about 40, that you've understood the way you're starting to understand the way your parents affected you, and how long the struggle is to be yourself, and what you have to prepare for the rest of your life, so you have those big glimmerings of important things, and I think that's the kind of thing that makes the Graduate Institute so vivacious.
There's always this question of how much you bring to the how much you bring to a text versus how much you behold the text for what it is.
Yes.
itself, and this is something that I remember thinking about quite a bit when I was at St. John's, because you can map a lot onto it, you can project a lot onto
yes.
it that may may distort the text.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's why we need other people. That's why we need our friends as correctives to tell you, wait a minute, I don't think that's in the text. I think you're imposing there. You know, and that other people are necessary.
When I was there, there was a program that I think was just drying up where they had scholarships for Chicago inner city school teachers. So you had these incredibly bright, often African-American teachers coming to St. John's for the summer, coming to Santa Fe for the summer. And they brought something that was unbelievable. I mean, I remember one guy reading Machiavelli and saying, oh, this is just a handbook. And then by the time I finished, there wasn't anything like that, and the demographics of the class had shifted remarkably. It was really just people who could afford to pay. What is it like now? How do you, are there methods for ensuring a varied classroom in the Graduate Institute?
Yes, we try. We have generous financial aid programs. We try to bring in interesting people who need more help. But you know, in the early days of the Graduate Institute, there was more money around. Foundations were more willing to support something exciting and new, and we want to seek those foundations out still. We're still trying, and I would love to get more inner city people. I'd love to get more local people. I'd love to get Native Americans. Scott Momaday, who's on the board now, I remember conversations with him about the Eastern Classics program, where he was actually very excited about the similarities between between Eastern thinking and Native American thinking. And so, you know, I'd love it if some generous foundation would give us money to, you know, so we can bring, you know, 8 to 10 Native Americans to the Eastern Classics program and see what's generated from there. Yeah, we have also a wonderful program of teachers' grants. You know, we give up to 50% of tuition to teachers from all over the country.
So, and it's great for them because, of course, they've got the summers off, so yes. St. John's summer program fits right in.
Yes, that's right. And it's doable during the spring and fall for local people, too, because of the evening classes.
When I was at St. John's, one of the things that struck me from time to time in the text that we read was, at certain points, just massive sexism. And I had a hard time with it, and, you know, argued in class, and I'm sure it was very unpleasant to my poor beleaguered tutors who had to deal with me. But I mean, it's real. And how do you deal with it as a tutor? How are your students dealing with some of this material? I mean, I remember somewhere in the works of Plato there's a section about how about reincarnation. If somebody is very good, they ascend to the next level. But if they're really bad, they come back as a woman. And if they're even worse, then they come back as a dog. And you know, so we were somewhere between man and dog.
You know, well, many women students, when they talk to me, and they say that one way they get through it is that you know everyone's got their blind spots. No one's omniscient. And you know, if we were to write something, we'd offend some major group of people too. So you read these books and you try to get what's great about them for you, you know.
But it does bring up the question of is it a little isolatable blind spot, or is it germane to the whole text? I mean, does it color? Yeah. Is the whole text just inherently sexist? And you know, you can't just sort of excise that part out surgically.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And you know, it needs to be thought about. You know, it's not a question that one can, you know, simply react to. You know, for example, with a Greek text, I think, you know, that one way this kind of sexism can permeate the whole is that sometimes you get the feeling that that the Greek texts represent the vision of life of what is essentially an adolescent male. You know, that there's only like half of the human experience there. You know, for example, patience for the Greeks is not a virtue. It might seem as feminine, a little bit too passive. All the Greek virtues tend to be active. You know, one could take that view of things. Then you have to work through it. You know, there might also be something true in that way of looking at things, and you need to think about that. So you know, the way I tend to think about it is that I like to think about striving for some kind of intelligent androgyny, in my spirit. But then you have to weigh the sides carefully and thoughtfully. And you can't simply dismiss it, but you have to wrestle with it.
And wrestling with it is something that really does take place in the classroom, and it's an incredibly fruitful process, I have found. And, you know, if anybody wants to be a talk show host, it's a great preparation for that. But what happens, and how do you, as a tutor, because you're not really leading the classes, you're just sort of guiding them and almost sort of herding them, maybe reining them in here and there. How do you, when things get out of hand, how do you teach? What's your role?
What are you imagining when you say things get out of hand? What do you have in mind?
Somebody going on a long angry monologue and ceasing to listen to their peers, or you know, ego games where somebody is trying very hard to dominate somebody else, or a class where all the boys are talking and all the girls are silent.
Uh-huh. Then I personally tend to be very upfront about it. I'll say, this seems to be an ego game where all the boys are talking and all the girls are silent.
You say that?
Yeah, I say that. I'll say that. Or I'll say, do you like this dynamic? You know, is anyone happy coming to this class? And then the answer is going to be yes or no. And chances are, if there's a bunch of people that don't like the way things are going, there'll be more people who don't like the way things are going. But yeah, but usually I find that if people feel that they're being listened to, then they get better.
Do you have favorite texts within the St. John's program yourself?
Yes, quite a few.
What are some of your favorites?
Shakespeare has always been a deep love of mine. At St. John's, I discovered Plato, and Apollonius, the Greek mathematician who did the geometry of conic sections. That stuff is as beautiful as Bach. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever come across. But you have to go through the whole of Euclid for that. Of the Eastern texts, the Zhuangzi. I've grown to love the early Buddhist texts.
Now, you, as a tutor, all the tutors at St. John's have to not only, I mean, you come in with a specialty in English literature, but you little by little expand to where you're teaching every, you're capable of, and you end up doing, teaching every class in the whole curriculum.
Yes. It's very intimidating. And
I mean, you have to learn, we didn't even talk about the fact that you have to learn Greek as an undergraduate.
Yes, yeah. It's very, they have to learn Greek and French as an undergraduate. It's very intimidating, you know, but it's good for tutors to be kept on their toes and to be intimidated, because then they know what the students feel like, and they can, because this is a place where people characteristically work out of their weakness. Right? Other places, you're always working out of your strengths. You know, you do something well, your teacher tells you, oh, you did great, you should do more of that. And you do that well, oh, great, you should do a PhD, you should consider a career in that. And at St. John's, because of the kind of mandatory broad curriculum, you're forced to stretch. You know, you may think of yourself as a literature person, but you've got to do the math, you've got to do the philosophy. And people go there who want to be expanded, who want to be put in this place of pitch darkness where they can't, you know, they don't understand anything, they butt their heads against the wall, and that makes them feel alive, because they're pushing against their boundaries. But because we think that it's good for the students to do that as human beings, we put ourselves in the same position. We don't ask them to do anything that we don't do.
There's one thing that I wondered where it might not work, which is there's an undergraduate music component, and there are some people who just aren't musical and some people who are very musical. Is there sort of ever an excuse where somebody says, I just can't teach the music program?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And we cut them slack. We know it's not easy. I myself have not taught the music program, even though I love music. And because I have this utmost terror of destroying a love of music in these young people. If I don't do this well, they're going to hate Beethoven. They're going to hate Brahms. That would be awful.
That would be
sleep.
Very bad.
I couldn't sleep.
We're talking to Krishnan Venkatesh, who's the director of the Graduate Institute of Liberal Education at St. John's College. Do you find that there are students that are going through both the Eastern and the Western classics?
Yes. It's a growing group of people. Every year we have about three, I think, who do the other program. And actually, I'm rather proud of the phenomenon. It's a new thing where you have people who are global core curriculum people. You know, they know great books from several traditions. You know, it's amazing, and I think it can only happen in Santa Fe, really. You know, with Santa Fe's cosmopolitanism, and at St. John's, we actually have this new kind of person who can stand. You know, who has the wherewithal to stand like outside two sets of cultures.
What about Annapolis, which is where the other branch of St. John's College is? Are they also teaching the Eastern there?
No, they don't do the Eastern there. We're the only campus that does that. But we still see the Eastern Classics program as a St. John's program. You know, so for Annapolis too, when they have students who are interested in it, they they point them to Santa Fe, says, you know, it's still, this program belongs to both campuses.
There is, for those of us, those of our listeners who are listening to this and thinking, boy, I'd like to participate in that, and who can't do a whole degree program, master's degree, there are also community seminars that people, that the public is invited to, and they do the reading beforehand and so on. Can you get really a taste of what the St. John's method is if you just go once? I mean, because part of it is learning through repetition, to do that kind of talking and listening. Does it work when people just show up for one class at a time?
Yeah, I myself don't. I'm not a big fan of the one class community seminar thing because it takes a while for a group to get together and learn to work together. But I really enjoyed the community seminar series, where you might have 6 or 8 series, one every week, on, you know, to study a given text or a group of texts. For example, I've done Shakespeare community seminar series for the last few years, and they are wonderful. You have a good mix there of people who are veterans at this kind of thing. Some of them are alums, some of them GI alums, some of them are people, you know, fresh from town, some of them just from out of the country. And they're all experienced. That most of them tend to be like 50s to 60s. They're very good readers, they're very intelligent, they're quite worldly. And also that women over 50 tend to be absolutely shameless. They will say whatever is in their minds. And that's really wonderful and exciting.
Women over 50 tend to be absolutely shameless.
Yes.
You heard it here first. what kind of things do they say?
This is not for public consumption.
Ah, okay. You're listening to KSFR 101.1 FM. Shameless public radio. Do you keep in touch with people who have gone through the graduate institute, gone through undergraduate, and see what they do with their lives and how they use? I mean, one of the things when I was in an undergraduate, people would always ask you, you're a sophomore, junior, senior, what are you going to do with your degree? And which is at the St. John's, especially at St. John's, sort of a silly question. But what do people go on to do, and how do they use their what they learned and the methods of learning that they use at St. John's?
Lots of different ways. We have great variety of post St. John's careers. You know, many go into PhD programs. Many go into further into teaching. You know, they discover a love of the classroom and a love of reading and learning and thinking. Many of them become entrepreneurs because this is a great place where you learn to think for yourself and come up with new things.
Well, we want to thank you for being here on KSFR. And how can people get in touch if they want to find out more about the Graduate Institute or more about St. John's College?
They could feel free to email me, K Venkatesh, KVENKATESH, at sjcsf.edu.
And if you missed that, we can give the phone number, which is 984-6083. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us here on KSFR.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor.
We've been talking to Krishnan Venkatesh, director of the Graduate Institute of Liberal Education at St. John's College, where he teaches as well as administers the graduate program. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's the website where you can hear the show any time of day or night just by clicking on the date you want, whether it's today or any other day in the last several months. All this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Tomorrow we have a very special program. I have done an interview with opera composer Tan Dun, and we are going to be playing that, where he discusses his opera Tea, A Mirror of Soul, which is going to be presented tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Opera, and we'll be hearing a little bit of music from that opera as well. All this and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR 101.1 FM. Hasta mañana. Ciao.